We're breaking from our weekly podcast to bring you highlights from WSJ Tech's DLive conference in Laguna Beach, California.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
Uber is the largest ride-sharing company in the world. Its chief executive, Dara Khosrowshahi, shares his roadmap for expansion while plotting the course for an IPO. He joins the Wall Street Journal's editor-at-large, Gerard Baker.
Dara, welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Busy time for you. Thank you for coming. Let me start, if I may, by asking you, Wall Street Journal published a story last month saying that your long-awaited and much-anticipated IPO, which everybody's talking about for next year, is being touted, possibly, at least by your investment banks, as valuing the company at $120 billion, up from the $70 billion, I think, just in the last round when SoftBank invested earlier this year. Raised a few eyebrows at story. I'm not expecting you to confirm or deny it, although do feel free to do so if you're so minded. Let me pose the question slightly differently. What is it do you think about, whatever the actual valuation might be eventually, what is it do you think about the company, and you've been chief executive for just over a year now, that a company like Uber that gives that company a potential valuation that is larger than the combined valuation of Ford, General Motors, and Fiat Chrysler?
So the number that was quoted was your number, not our number, just to be specific. I think the opportunity that we have as a company and our industry generally has is to really revolutionize mobility in general. And when you look at the mobility pie, this is a $6 trillion market. And what we're going after is essentially to debundle car ownership. Just as the cable bundle has been debundled, we are going after all of the use cases of why someone would own a car. There are over a billion cars in the world. And we think a world in which the people who can not afford to buy a car have access to consistent mobility wherever they are. We think that's a better world. And as a market, it's a $6 trillion addressable market that we're going after in terms of moving people and things and freight. And I think we're in the driver's seat.
Nobody's driving, though, in the old
time. Well, eventually, maybe that'll be the case. So when you have that big a market and you're a company that is in the lead with multiple platforms that are taking on this mobility as a service, I think that we certainly have the opportunity to earn our way into that reported value and then some.
From what you described then, just sort of this very broad $6 trillion market, Uber Eats, freight, autonomous vehicles, delivery by drone. I mean, the company's been talking about just in the last year, perhaps, you know, Uber Work, something beyond, you know, just the immediate transportation opportunities. Is it kind of like, you know, let's sort of just try all of these things and see what looks best, see what the best opportunity is? Or do you have a focused vision on what you think the company will be in 2, 3, 5 years' time?
Well, we certainly have a focus in terms of mobility and transportation for people and things in urban locations, all right? So if you live in a city, and if you live in the center of a city or in the outskirts of the city, we want to make transportation available for you on demand, available anytime, very much affordably. And we want to make it available to you through cars and taxis and bikes and scooters and mass transportation as well. And we have a big dream there in terms of bringing all of that together. But I think we're uniquely positioned as a company to build tech that makes all of those experiences real time, hopefully priced real time as well in a dynamic way, and available to you in a delightful way as far as payments go. We can be your everyday movement service. We can be your everyday eating service, you know, in terms of breakfast, lunch, dinner. And I think we can play a very, very big part in how freight is moved around this country and hopefully internationally as well. Each of those are enormous trillion-plus dollar opportunities, and we're getting pretty good signal. So the opportunities here are enormous. It looks like we're going after a lot of opportunities, and I think for me the challenge is, how do you create teams that are focused on each of these opportunities and kind of live and die by their successes? And then how do we, as a overall corporate entity, make sure that we have the best people going after each of these opportunities?
Let me come in some detail on some of these. I want to talk about some of these specific opportunities one by one. But let's focus on the core for now. One of the reasons I think skeptics. There are skeptics out there, and particularly skeptics about a valuation of the sort that we've been talking about. And again, no one doubts the scale of the market and the terrific opportunities that exist there. But they look at your core business, which is, you know, obviously far and away currently the bulk of the revenue, the ride-sharing business. And they say this is based on a business model that doesn't really seem viable in the long term. I mean, I just quote to you, from something that you issued a memorandum for a private debt placement just recently, just last month. And I think the quote was, "We acknowledge that our operating losses will increase substantially in the near future." So you still, you know,
are you quoting the risk factors for me?
Yeah, well, you can tell us about the risk factors, but your core business isn't profitable. The operating margin isn't profitable, and there are some good reasons for that. And I want to go into it. But what's your expectation of the ride-sharing business and how that becomes profitable in a relatively short time horizon?
So the ride-sharing business is already contribution margin positive in a number of markets. And contribution margin is not an accounting term, but I'll describe it in real life, which is after, you know, gross bookings and how much we pay, and we pay the majority of our gross bookings to our driver partners. After you pay driver partners, you pay them incentives, marketing in a market, and the cost of the field staff in a market, how much money is coming in from those markets. And we are contribution margin positive and significantly contribution margin positive in a number of markets in the ride-sharing space.
Your gross bookings, the rate of growth of your gross bookings is slowing quite sharply. I looked at some numbers. You were growing at over 100% 2 years ago, and the latest figures, I think it was at 41%. So you're on a very, quite sharply slowing
trajectory.
Listen,
I think lots of companies at our scale would kill for 41% growth, right? It's a law of large numbers at some point, and then we've got businesses like Eats that are growing at 150%+. So we have a mix of businesses, and there are some businesses that are naturally going to mature as they scale. But as they are scaling, actually, the contribution margin, we've demonstrated in some markets that contribution margin is positive. In the U.S., which is our largest market, we're in a big battle with Lyft. So I can't claim that for the U.S., and that's a challenge. We have to earn our way there. But I think that when an investor looks at our business, they can see an example of the business model working today. And then we have businesses like Eats and Freight and, for example, bikes and scooters, which we think have lots of potential. And I think the fact that we've demonstrated contribution positivity today will allow us, I think, to get to contribution positive in a number of these businesses. And there's no other business that has a platform that's not only global, but is also multi-product as well. So I think we've got structural advantages that none of our local and kind of call it vertical or single product players do. And I think, it's ours to lose.
But you know the criticism. I mean, the core criticism is that your business model rests on a cost base, essentially, that involves paying drivers something pretty well close to minimum wage. And that for a business that's growing, that's continuing to grow, and as you say, growing into all of these other areas with other opportunities, but is growing nonetheless, even at that, you're not profitable. You're not making profits in overall. You may in some markets. How can you sustain at a time when the economy is growing strongly, when unemployment is declining, your turnover of drivers, I think, is pretty significant, 25% a year, something like that. How can you sustain a business on the basis of, contract people who work for you are on contract, they're not employees, you don't have to pay them all the benefits that employees get. But as a business model, how does that provide a path to long-term growth for you?
Well, I think the path to long-term growth is exactly what I said, which is we've shown that under this model, we can be contribution margin positive. Our driver partners have the flexibility to drive with us whenever they want or not. 50% of our driver partners, for example, in the U.S., drive for us 10 hours or less. So there is a significance in the freedom that they have to dip in or not. And we are systematically improving our driver partners' experience in terms of the predictability of their earnings. In Europe, for example, we provide insurance through AXA, life insurance, pregnancy leave, maternity leave, et cetera. So systematically, we are going out and using technology and also our own pocketbooks to improve the experience of being a driver partner as well. And I think the model itself, most of the gross bookings that come in actually go out to our driver partners, and that's fine. But the business is scaling, and the demand for this kind of transportation service has been demonstrated to be consistent all over the world. And then there are markets like Germany and Japan and Argentina that we haven't really penetrated that we think are substantial growth opportunities going forward.
And those geographies you mentioned, because you was recently pulled out of Southeast Asia, but you, Japan is a, you know, obviously, and you've got the SoftBank connection, so that's presumably a favorable circumstances for you. But Japan is something you regard as a big opportunity?
Japan is already a market that is growing very healthily on the Eats side of the business. So Eats is actually leading in Japan. And now we are looking to partner up with taxi services because taxi is a huge market in Japan. And we're going in and now partnering with local taxi companies in order to build our business in Japan as well. So we're pretty optimistic there.
So let's move on. Moving on to these other opportunities that you've talked about, significant opportunities in this big market. You talked about Uber Eats and you talked about freight. I was struck you didn't talk particularly about, although it comes obviously within both of those, but you didn't talk specifically about autonomous vehicles. And Uber's invested a lot in autonomous vehicles, famously, you know, hiring the entire autonomous vehicle faculty from Carnegie Mellon. You made some good progress. You've had some setbacks with the awful fatal accident in Arizona recently. Mm-hmm. It's been reported that there's a lively debate going on about whether or not autonomous vehicles as a separate unit, as its own unit, is something that you want to continue with, or whether you might just you use the autonomous vehicle expertise that you have and the science that you have to work with partners. Can you tell us what your current thinking is on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I consider autonomous as being part of the core rideshare business. We're in the autonomous vehicle development business because we believe in rideshare, and we believe that long-term autonomous vehicles are going to be safer than human-driven vehicles. That's ultimately the game that we're playing over a period of time. The advantage that we have as it relates to our autonomous business is, one, we have incredible talent there. They've gone through a tough year, and now the focus is to get back on the road in as safe way as possible. I'm optimistic that we will get there. But the advantage that we have is substantial in having autonomous and the rideshare business under the same roof, because essentially, our autonomous team already knows what to develop for in terms of commercialization of the technology, and we can actually go out there and build a hybrid network in that we don't have to recreate every single human behavior. And let's say unprotected left turns are tough in certain cities. We can only call for an autonomous vehicle for a ride that doesn't require an unprotected left turn in a particularly busy street. So we think having autonomous and the network under one roof is a huge advantage. At the same time, we are very much willing to work with other autonomous providers as well. So we view autonomous as an enabling technology for the industry in general. We want to be a part of that development, but ultimately we're going to work with third parties as well.
So there have been talks, for example, at Toyota, somebody we work with?
Yeah, I think Toyota is actually a very close partner working on our core ATG business. But we'll also work with players who are developing their own autonomous technology. And ultimately, autonomous is going to be both safe, but it's also going to take the cost per mile of our service down to be comparable with car ownership. And when we are comparable with car ownership, essentially, you've set the stage for this business not to grow 2x or 3x, but 20 or 30x. So it is a incredibly important enabling technology for us to be a company that's multiples bigger than where we are today.
So I'm going to take this conversation, because I'm an eye on the clock, I'm going to take this conversation in a direction, slightly unprotected left turn direction from autonomous vehicles, if I may, to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been a big investor in Uber, both directly through the Public Investment Fund and obviously indirectly through its investments with SoftBank. Until a couple of months ago, I think most people saw that as a kind of an unalloyed blessing, right? You had a lot of Saudi money. This is a huge source of funding for you and enabled you to do all kinds of important deals as a result. Obviously, following the terrible murder of Jamal Khashoggi, we are in a slightly different situation.
Yes.
You immediately chose not to go to the big conference in Saudi Arabia just last month, and were followed by lots of other people too. This blessing of Saudi Arabian money does look like it's turning into a bit of a burden right now. How do you, and we're still waiting, obviously, to see what is the outcome of the investigation, what happened there. How does it affect your relationship with, and by the way, of course, you've got a member, the PIF chairman, I think, on the board of Uber. How are you handling that relationship right now?
Listen, I think it's a sensitive situation. When I pulled out of the conference, and we didn't follow the herd on that, we were quite early there. We didn't know the facts, but we thought that it was inappropriate for us to go at that point based on just what had happened. And I think now we're in a situation where we can wait to get the facts. And once we get the facts and understand exactly what happens, we will do our best to react as a company. And it's the company is a bunch of humans making judgments. And, you know, one of our norms is we do the right thing, period. But that's based on our judgment as to what the right thing is. And this is a situation that isn't entirely clear. At the same time, Saudi is a big investor in the company, and we have a fiduciary duty to serve all of our investors, and they have a board seat. And so far, they've been a terrific board member. So until we learn more, we're not in a position to act one way or the other. The act itself was horrible. And, you know, we're anxious to learn more. And then we'll talk to our board and we'll decide what the best way forward is.
What could you do? I mean, we don't know the outcome of the investigation, but supposing the investigation were to find that it was the killing were directly tracked to the Crown Prince, to the government, what can you do? I think it's Mr. Al-Rumayyan who's still on your board.
Yes,
I mean,
sir, yes.
Have you had conversations with him about you staying on your board, or is there some way around it?
I mean, it's putting the cart before the horse, right? None of those determinations have been made. So we haven't had those discussions. You know, Yasser's been a very strong board member. They have a right to a board seat, and they have a right to be a shareholder at this point. And until that changes, that's going to remain the norm, and, you know, we'll see what happens from here.
Of course, one way that would presumably cut through this would be to go public more quickly. That would make you...
Yeah, listen, less... for us, we're obviously, that's a target for us next year.
Now, do you have kind of time frame in mind?
2019 is a target. That's okay. A time frame.
All right.
And I think at that point, anyone is free to be a shareholder one way or the other. And I think we enter into public land, which obviously has benefits and also can be difficult as well.
Let me turn to the culture of the company. Mm-hmm. You came in just over a year ago. You took over in, it's fair to say, fairly tumultuous circumstances. The founder, Travis Kalanick, had been ousted after what were widely deemed to be some transgressions, shall we say, and both presiding over and indeed perhaps even encouraging a culture that a lot of people found very unacceptable, all kinds of stories which we're all very familiar with. What have you done to address that? What do you think you've achieved so far, and how is the company different culturally from how it was 15 months ago?
Well, one of the first things that we did when I came in was look to refactor the values and the norms of the company as far as, and we call them norms, which is, it's expected behaviors, right? We didn't want it to be kind of words on a wall. And we actually went out and crowdsourced from our employee base, what kind of a company do you think is a great company? What kind of a company do you want to be proud to work for? And what came was very clear signal from the team in terms of what kind of company that they want to work at. And so we went out there and set forward a set of norms that would define behavior with an Uber. And it's norms like we celebrate differences and we act like owners and we value ideas over hierarchy and we do the right thing, period. Now that those norms are set and I have a management team that's a combination of new and old, now we have to move those behaviors into the everyday. And I think as a company externally, I think we've demonstrated that we've changed. And we are now much more inclusive in terms of working with cities and governments and being very open with our driver partners as far as how we build and how we innovate, something that I'm really excited about. In that, you know, it's not growth just our way, but it's growth, inclusive growth with partnership, which is how we are demonstrating what kind of a company we are externally. And internally, it's still a journey. You know, internally, I think if anything, if I were to criticize myself in my first year, I'd say externally, we did a pretty good job as far as demonstrating actually how we are a different company. Internally, I think we have more to do. I think we've set the norms out. I think that we are starting to change as a company and become the kind of company that we're proud of, but we have more work to do to make sure that those behaviors not only define how I act, how my leadership team acts, but how 4 or 5 levels down, you know, in France, one of our operational managers is acting.
I mean, you're very different management style and a very different personality. No videos of you shouting at drivers, for example. You don't seem like that. But nonetheless, despite what you say about changing the public impression, there have been some continuing criticisms. There's the issue over Cameron Pitcher, I think it was, who was your head of business development, who was accused of inappropriate behavior with employees. I think he just recently did leave the company. Initially, he didn't. He moved. And then there's also been a question mark about arguably differential treatment between, I think, is it Barney Harford, your COO, and Leanne Hansie, is it, who left? It was a woman who left the company after accusations again of inappropriate behavior. So there's some criticisms out there still that maybe you're not perhaps being quite as, you know, there's a lot of attention on Silicon Valley companies in this right now, but you're not being quite as vigilant about ensuring that you have a proper culture that respects all kinds of people there too. I mean, how do you respond to those criticisms?
I think the way that I respond is, one, I don't want to comment on the individual circumstances because they are personal. And by the way, they're very different. I can't control how individuals act within our company. But what I can control is how we respond. And I think we have responded in the right way, in a way that would make people proud. And I think every day as a company, we are getting better and better and more consistent. And it's a process. So are there going to be criticisms of how we act? Sure. But I think those criticisms come, the space between those criticisms is going to expand. And I'm very confident that as a company today, we're better than we were 6 months ago. And 6 months from now, we'll be much better.
Good. Please, we've got a few minutes for some questions. So please, we've got Dara here, please. If you could identify yourself. And I would just wait for the microphone, which is just coming. There you go. Thank you.
Hey, Dara. Jason. Hi. From Comparably. Our company's in Santa Monica, two blocks from the beach, which is ground zero for the scooter wars.
Yes, yes.
I think there's five companies now.
Lots of them.
How do you see that business shaping out over time?
So I think if you step back, I think that there's a very exciting beginning of a revolution going on in individual electric vehicles in terms of urban transportation. We bought a company called Jump, which is electric bikes. And actually, I think we have that space all to ourselves, which is wonderful. They're great pieces of equipment. And what we found is that the average distance that our e-bikes were being ridden was 2.7 miles, which is about 30 to 40% of our rides were 2.7 miles or less. So these vehicles are being used and overlay with a huge part of our present network. And if you're traveling as an individual 2.7 miles in a city, Santa Monica or San Francisco, you shouldn't take, you know, a 3,000, 4,000 pound car. It's not good for the environment. It's not good for the city. It's a waste of time for you and not particularly healthy. So we think that actually these vehicles that are coming out, listen, it's an early technology. Are there too many scooters in Santa Monica? Yes. Are we going to be one of the players who lasts? Yes, because we have a network and we have demand out there. But I think the point here is that scooters are V1 of these new vehicles that are coming out. I am hoping that regulators in the city see these scooters and bikes for the treasure that they are, that they're going to get cars off the road. And during rush hour, when one of our driver partners is kind of called, that driver partner doesn't want the 2 mile trip. That driver partner wants the trip to the airport. So actually, we're taking the less attractive trips for our network and we're transferring those trips to scooters and bikes, which is great for the city, it's great for the environment, it's great for the user, and it's also good for our driver partners as well. So we're really optimistic in this market. I'm wondering how big the market will be in places that don't have wonderful weather like Santa Monica. So we'll see how winter acts. But I'm pretty optimistic in this market, and we're investing pretty aggressively.
One more very quick question. If there's one last one, yes.
Thank you. So you're going to have to work with regulators.
Yes.
You have a fierce head-to-head competitor. But in this space, your interests are aligned. Can you see a point where you will have to work with them, to work with the regulators to accomplish what needs to be done?
Yeah, listen, we're working with regulators today. It may surprise you.
No. My question was, will you have to work with your direct competitor to... Will you have to work with Lyft?
You're talking about Lyft.
You need to accomplish...
I don't know who you were talking about, a direct competitor. They're a competitor, but I don't direct. So will we work with them? Yeah, sure. I actually do think that this is, you know, we and Lyft together account for less than 1% of miles driven in the cities in which we operate. People associate, we're a headline company, but we're a tiny, tiny, tiny part of the market. And ultimately, both of us are going after car ownership. We don't think people should own cars, and we don't think the only people who get around in a city or we don't think people who can afford cars should have the best transportation around. So I think from that standpoint, in working with regulators and trying to build out a framework that is friendly to the city, friendly to environments, and ultimately makes transportation available to everyone everywhere, not just folks in the city center, that's in both of our interests, and I think we would be happy to work with them to push that vision of a world forward.
My app says that Dara's driver is 1 minute away, so... oh, no, he just canceled, so we got another 10. No,
thank you for that.
Not at all. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Dara very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green and Garrett Crow. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcast. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Thanks to our editors on the live journalism team, Yoon-hee Kim, Nikki Waller, and Kim Last, and special thanks to festival organizers Anna Raftal, Andrea Acosta, and Robin Wood-Saylor. Be sure to check back for regular episodes in the weeks ahead, including special reporting on the Earth's changing climate. And remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in Laguna Beach, California.